Thank you for joining Bevel Talk, Season 1, Episode 6. Pipe welding in the field can be challenging. Today, we are talking about embracing new technologies and the ROI in a competitive world. Let's get right into it.
Welcome to Bevel Talk, the podcast where we discuss the everyday challenges of welding pipe in the field. We're joined again with Chris and Justin from Kiewit. Today, guys, we want to talk about productivity. I know sometimes that's a dirty word, depending on what you're doing. Welders think that you're trying to get more out of me. Sometimes it relates to quality, other things. So let's talk for a minute about the scope of a build, right? Tell me how many welds or how many inches of weld, feet of weld, whatever you want to do, number of welds are on an average power plant job.
On a power plant, I do all my math by diameter inches. So a 6-inch pipe, for example, is 6 diameter inches. We're about 25,000 to 30,000 diameter inches, which equates to roughly 1,500, 2,000 large bore welds. On top of that number, you have another at least 1,000, depending on how we build the project, small bore welds, socket welds as well. When you get in the big OGC work mega project, you're 100,000 DI and up of just field welds. So none of those numbers account for any of the shop fabricated pipe.
That's all just in the
just
field.
Just in the field.
Wow. So what are the major contributors or what are the major things that are slowing productivity down when you're welding those joints?
Really, it's just like any sort of manufacturing flow. It's having the work available. So when you're stick building something in the middle of a field somewhere, having an efficient system to constantly have fresh scope being opened up to work on, that's what makes a good contractor, I suppose. But we all have, you know, our issues, whether it's weather, delivery, you name it, anything preventing us from getting joints in front of the welders. But on top of that, I would just say complexity. If you look how plants were built 30, 40 years ago, I mean, they were still very, very complex, but you know, from a material standpoint, they were generally called easier to weld materials. We weren't as advanced materials we use today. Inspection techniques weren't as critical, and timelines necessarily weren't always as tight sometimes as what we see today. We get a lot of push to tighten our timelines up. So, you know, when you're asking welders to perform on hard weld materials that are getting inspected to a greater level of scrutiny, that definitely plays into our timeline.
Reading between the lines, you're telling me that material types have changed quite a bit in the last couple of decades, as well as timelines, and it's more difficult for these guys to do their job, right?
It's getting more and more technical, yeah.
What are you doing, or what is industry doing as a whole to combat that? How do we remain at least as productive or gain productivity while maintaining quality?
Trying to leverage these advanced waveforms in the welding environment anyway. When we start talking these higher alloy materials, there might not necessarily be a filler metal, for example, that's an off-the-shelf product we can use to partner with R&D, for example. So it's working with suppliers to develop formulations that are adequate and have the weldability and the mechanical properties. We're seeing a shift actually as we speak right now where we're seeing another material come down the pipeline on power plants that we haven't seen a lot before. So we're starting to go through this iterative process again of trying to get the correct filler metals developed so we can keep using the processes that we like to use from a productivity standpoint. It really takes staying out ahead of things as much as we can, you know, trying to stay ahead of industry trends. Because when you're working in that sort of area, there isn't an off-the-shelf solution. So a lot of R&D goes into that. And our suppliers are, you know, Miller, which is a large one for us, are crucial working together to have a solution that we need.
Do you see the movement to higher alloy material and these changes in material types or filler metal types speeding up, slowing down, or remaining the same?
I don't have a good answer for that, I don't think. There's a couple reasons why. There's a lot of really great alloys out there. But from an owner standpoint, kind of back to, hey, we go out, we have to sell, we're going to do it maybe a little differently than somebody else, leverage this technology where somebody else isn't. We have to get them comfortable with that. Well, same goes when we're picking alloys for some certain pipe grades. They might say, yeah, we'd rather go with this thicker pipe at a you know, more trusted or an alloy with more service history behind it, then immediately jump on to another alloy that maybe there isn't a service life, and we're not sure we're going to get a 30 or 40 year plant out of this. So the industry is pretty slow to change just because they're so concerned of downstream effects that obviously are detrimental to the bottom line if you have an outage because a material failed. And there's been plenty of, you know, noted material failures over the years as new alloys got developed, and we've learned to work with them a little bit more and a little bit better. But the other aspect to that is we're seeing another alloy come about because code is making some changes that are downgrading some of our allowable stress levels. So it's almost a forced hand in this equation that the efficiency of a power plant is directly related to how hot you can run your main steam and how much pressure you can run it under. So if you can run it hotter and heavier, you're going to need an alloy that can do that to help the plant make more money. So it's a trade-off on all accounts. And that's why it's a bit of a tough answer to have, just because there's a lot of factors that play into it.
So do you see that as a trend going forward, as having to do more and more R&D as power plants are trying to become more and more efficient, get more and more out of them?
Yeah, I mean, that will continue in the future for all these industries. I think it just kind of goes in spurts. You'll have a code revision that will cause something, or you have a new formulation of metal come out that people are starting to look at. We joke about power plants that from a metallurgical standpoint, they're pretty simple because all we're doing is boiling water as opposed to like a chemical process, or, you know, where you have a lot more intricate temperature, pressure, but also corrosion attributes that you're taking into account. So yeah, it kind of like, yeah, it's got growth spurts every 10, 15 years where new materials come out. There's finally enough confidence in that material to use it. And then we start doing our R&D from a contractor standpoint to be able to adapt to it.
Outdated equipment threatens productivity, profitability, and safety. Learn how Miller XMT 350 Field Pro systems with ArcReach can improve your job site at millerwelds.com/ArcReach.
We're talking about productivity. We're talking about changes. We're talking about adapting. How do you, in these kind of projects, these power plant projects, these large projects, track productivity? What are you doing? I mean,
I think that's a good point with this, or some of the programs that we're working on right now, that I think Justin could speak to these a little more detail than I could, being that he's managing these now. You elaborate on that?
We have the luxury at Kiewit of relying on, you know, this robust software program that we've got. Some third-party ones, we have a lot of in-house ones, but you know, I could sit on my computer right now and pull up our daily productivity on any project, which is a great tool as a manager to have. So we can highlight projects that are underperforming. We can highlight projects that are overperforming in the same light. But it really comes down to, you know, basic metric is how many DIs are we producing per man hour of work put into it. You can get in the weeds and really start talking about deposition rates, pounds per hour, and all that sort of stuff. But really, to take into account all the aspects of a construction site that play into it, it really is the DI, or diameter inch per man hour, metric that we look closest at.
Justin and Chris, when we look at equipment development and some of the things that we do to try to help with productivity, we're trying to put the control of the weld more in the hands of the welder themselves to try and eliminate movement on the job site. Is that helping you guys at all, some of the changes in the technology of the equipment today versus what you had in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with traditional welding processes, you could have two welders in the site weld two different, totally different ways. And with Miller's R&D process, we're able to train these guys to a standard that we feel works best for us, and we've got a proven track record with it. And we try to explain that to them and train our craft with that in mind. And you can go to pretty much any project across the United States that we're on, and one welder on the East Coast is welding pretty similar to one on the West Coast. And I think that's been a huge step in training and technology to take away a lot of these, you know, small details that these welders are coming up with and moving things around. And it's standardized the process across our districts.
When we look at welding productivity, one of the big numbers we look at is operating factor. So it's, percentage time spent welding versus non-welding. And in the field, you know, those numbers aren't very good, honestly. There's a lot that goes into string and lead, setting your machine up, going to the rod room, going to the bathroom, stretch and flex in the morning, having lunch. I mean, all these things go into what the cost to build the work is. So if there's ever a chance that I can keep the welder at their joint and more productive, meaning they're not walking back to the machine to go up, you know, a few amps. They can do that right at their power source. Anytime that they can set something up more simple, more fast, more intuitive, it's typically money for us because we're increasing that operating factor.
I always think about it like a crosscut saw versus a chainsaw, right? I really like using a crosscut saw once or twice, but when I really need to get something done, I'm going to pull out the chainsaw and go to work.
Yeah, we always laugh whenever we have to do tick stick PQRs. Most previous episodes I was talking about, we did a 2-inch P91 plate a couple weeks ago, tick stick, and I couldn't be at our facility here where we do the PQR work, so I called Chris and told him he had a real easy job ahead of him. He just had to weld this massive PQR plate with stick, and I was getting cursed texts for the entire day because it's when you RMD flux core, you run these high productivity processes, and you take a step back in time. It's like, oh, this is fun for about 5 minutes, and you're like, why do we still do this? Like, it's so obvious.
You know, to that point, quickly, you know, selling these advanced processes to seasoned veteran welders, it's got its own struggles, and we could all elaborate on that for days. But one thing that we've definitely seen, once we get these advanced processes in their hands and they've got a couple days or weeks under their belt, it's almost impossible to get them to go back and TIG weld them just because it is so it's slow. I mean, it's a great process, but it is not efficient.
And you start talking, you talk about P91 a lot, which is used for primary steam lines. It's an alloy used in primary steam lines and power mm-hmm. plants. Preheat, and that's 400 degrees. So do you want to be leaning up against this joint for a week at 400 degrees, or do you want to be leaning up against this joint for a day at 400 degrees? Once you get comfortable with these processes, again, back to the safety, but just welder comfort, making their job more enjoyable and honestly easier helps across the board.
I have a question regarding that. So change is hard, right? Especially for the more seasoned welders out there that they've done it this way forever and ever. How do you drive adoption and acceptance of process changes to these more seasoned welders?
I think first starts with the correct education. And Chris talked about this earlier with the people managing the work have to be able to do the work. So if you're going to come in and preach a better way, a new way of doing it that they're not used to, having the right person make the sales pitch has to be believable. And that person has to be able to put the hood on, has to make a convincing argument, kind of like a no BS sort of thing. Hey, if this person is really speaking from their true knowledge and really believes it's the right thing. The second is being empathetic. I think this goes unnoticed a lot, but a lot of times you're getting kickback from the craft because that's the skill set that they have and that's what, pays the bills. So here we are walking in as a big contractor going, nope, you're not going to do it the way you've done it for 20 years. You're going to do it our way. And you have to let them know we're here to help. You know, we're not going to kick you down the road just because of one silly reject. We're going to take that as a learning opportunity, make you a better welder because of it. And we've convinced a lot of welders, and like Chris was saying, a lot of them don't want to go back. But you have to be empathetic. You have to give them the right training and understand what they're going through. Just don't make it a one-way street.
So now we're going to get a little bit personal. I need you guys to fast forward 5-10 years from now. What do you see a construction site of the future being like? What is technology in the construction site of the future?
Man, that's deep. Yeah. Looking at how much it's changed in the last 100 years, I don't know if we're going to see much difference in 10 years. I know we're going to see more automation across the board. I like looking at European markets for some of the more automated technological-based solutions. For example, see machines that if you have to set anchor bolts and concrete pads that you lay out all the points, the machine goes around, drills the holes, puts the epoxy in, puts the anchor bolt, and you just let that thing go kind of like a Roomba for the vacuum cleaner, but this thing's setting anchor bolts all over the place for pipe supports or whatever. Obviously, construction sites are not easy to automate, but places where there's room for, I think you're going to see that more and more. Within the welding world, the casting type welding that, that we're familiar with. I think that's going to stick around for a little bit. I think there's some cool technology out there, but it's going to take a whole rethink of how we actually engineer our piping systems. Because under the, if you go into the current codes, B31, 313, you know, your typical piping codes you see in OGC and power markets, they don't lend themselves well to outside trains of thought when it comes to how joining is done. So if we're looking at things that might have a different joint efficiencies, by the classical sense of the term, it's going to take a lot. We know how slow the code bodies move to adapt and get to the point where we can actually use some really different joining technologies.
You have anything to add to that, Chris?
I was thinking about elaborating and going into more some orbital stuff. And that's where a lot of clients always are driving orbital. It's the same process. It's just a mechanized process, right? It moves for you.
Yeah, we're always looking at ROI, return on investment,
yeah.
And it boils down to pounds per hour and operating factor. So whatever we buy in the future, whatever path we go down, has to show a true return on investment in those two facets, or else it's not worth it. There's a lot of ways to skin the cat out there in the current market, but once you factor in initial capitalization costs, training and everything, they just don't pay for themselves, even though they might be a catchy technology or an overused kind of go-to sort of problem solver, or so people think. It really just boils down to those two factors. And if you look at productivity through that lens, I think you can make a lot of good decisions.
Couldn't agree with you more. We got to be careful about the technology we choose and what we're going to do on our job sites. Chris, Justin, thank you guys so much for your time. Thank you to Kiewit for letting you come and talk to us today for our podcast. This has been Bevel Talk, the podcast where we talk about the everyday challenges of pipe welding in the field. Please join us next time for season number 2.